in which the theme of the program is what's it going to take to get done in this economy what you want to get done in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, today, the 24th day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, you want things to happen, you got to put in the work. But sometimes the work you put in doesn't pan out. So with that as the setup, the global economy news of the day, President Biden signed an executive order today that the White House says is going to make supply chains in this economy more resilient and more secure. We saw, just by way of example, shortages of PPE early in this pandemic. There's been news the past couple of weeks about problems with semiconductor supplies hitting car makers. Those supplies in both those categories coming sometimes from overseas, and those are only the two most recent high-profile examples. The White House says it's going to take a hard look, find out where the vulnerabilities are, and come up with a way to fix them. But the United States has been offshoring its manufacturing for decades now and doesn't really have much to show for the work it's done trying to fix that. Marketplace's Bree Benishore gets us going.
It is not just that we didn't have enough masks during the pandemic. This order is about the future of U.S. competitiveness. Promoting that involves altering global supply chains. It won't be easy, but there are ways. Stephen Vogel chairs the political economy program at UC Berkeley.
It could be stockpiling certain things. In some cases, it could be trying to create a domestic manufacturing capacity where there isn't in a particular niche.
Practically speaking, that could mean public funding for research and development, or it could mean having the government promise to buy a strategic product. The U.S. promised to buy COVID vaccines before they were developed, for example, propping up pharmaceutical companies. There are lots more options, says CJ Muse at Evercore ISI.
It's, you know, tax subsidies, right? It's providing incentives to making investments here, right? And so I would like to see Washington, D.C. get creative.
In the past, the U.S. has relaxed antitrust rules to encourage U.S. companies that normally compete with one another to work together on research. When it comes to supply chains, making them reliable doesn't mean going it alone. Arthur Herman is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute.
Making a secure supply chain for critical industries doesn't necessarily mean everything has to be made here in the 48 states or even the 50 states.
Even the Pentagon relies on a handful of trusted countries like Canada and the UK to supply materials. But rearranging global supply chains and nurturing sensitive industries, this is not some small side project. Asia's highest tech semiconductor manufacturers, for example, took hundreds of billions of dollars and multiple decades to get where they are now. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Story two on the theme of how you're going to get done in this economy, what you want to get done in this economy, comes to us from Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell, testifying this week on Capitol Hill. Among the many other things Mr. Powell said is that the Fed is trying real hard to get this economy back to full employment, about which this. First of all, we are still down 10 million jobs from where we were at the beginning of all of this. Second of all, the official unemployment rate in this economy is 6.3%, as we have told you. But both Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen say the pandemic has done such violence to the American labor force and how we measure it that the real jobless rate a year on now is probably closer to 10%. So knowing all that, what do you suppose it might take to get back to full employment? Here's Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Think of full employment as an economic sweet spot. The unemployment rate is low enough that workers can find jobs easily and earn steadily higher wages. But it's not so low that employers can't find workers and have to bid wages up dramatically. Jesse Rothstein's an economist at UC Berkeley.
You don't have to worry that you're just queuing with a whole lot of other unemployed workers for scarce jobs. It means you have some negotiating power.
Economists say we hit full employment before the pandemic, when unemployment was at 3.5%. Now, unemployment's officially at 6.3%, or upwards of 10%, including all the folks who aren't being counted or have stopped looking.
No matter what measure you use, we're in a very serious recession.
Harvard economist Jason Furman says millions of jobs are still missing in bars and restaurants, hotels, education. He thinks many of them can be restored with another round of stimulus and widespread vaccination.
I think we can get a lot of the way back to full employment by the end of this year. I don't know that we can get all the way back that quickly, just because for some people, it's going to take them time to find new jobs.
And it'll be hardest for low-wage workers of color to get back to pre-pandemic employment levels, says economist Gary Hoover at Tulane University.
Even at its very best, Black unemployment was twice that of white unemployment. The response of Blacks to a shock like this takes longer and goes deeper.
Hoover says getting the whole country back to full employment will take specific policies, like assistance to Black small business owners and help paying for childcare. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
You ever heard the phrase, buy the dip? That's what was going on at the corner of Wall Street and Broad in Lower Manhattan today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There are, as you might imagine, a whole lot of moving parts as the White House and Democrats in the House of Representatives work on getting that big virus relief package passed, possibly by the end of the week. There is going to be straight-up money in it for people who've been hit hard by what the virus has done to this economy, but there are also going to be some changes to the tax code. Told you yesterday, Kimberly Adams did anyway, about a plan to expand the earned income tax credit. Today, what the bill might do for the child tax credit. Here is Kimberly one more time.
Eligible families already get a tax credit for every kid 16 and under once a year when they file their taxes. Under the Democratic proposal, they'd get monthly payments starting as soon as this summer, and their total benefit would grow.
So it's going to go up from $2,000 to $3,000 for all children, and then an additional $600 for young children.
Katherine Magnuson runs the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Another change? Right now, some families with the lowest incomes miss out on some of the benefit.
If you don't have a full tax bill, then you don't get the full credit.
Under this proposal, they would. The OECD says the U.S. has one of the highest child poverty rates in the developed world. Several analyses estimate these changes could lift 5 to 11 million children out of poverty. Katherine Mitchell-Moore teaches public administration at Syracuse.
The kids who don't receive the full credit right now are predominantly kids who are lower income, many who are living in poverty, and many who are either Black or Latino.
But as with the proposed $15 minimum wage, there are questions about whether this belongs in a pandemic response bill. Maya McGinnis at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget supports the idea of expanding the credit, but
it is a policy that should be structured for situations that exist outside of the COVID crisis. And it is a policy that is so important that it's permanent and durable that it should be paid for.
She points to a proposal by Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney that would overhaul funding for child poverty programs more broadly. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Marketplace Morning Report. That's it. That's the tag. With the news today of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine looking pretty good, according to the FDA, as drug makers try to ramp up supplies here, the vaccine gap over in Europe is proving politically embarrassing. Not enough shots inside the European Union, while in the United Kingdom, a recent high-profile departure from the EU, as you know, because we told you about it for like a year and a half, 2 years, vaccine rates there are significantly higher. And as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from London, that is not going down well with Europe's economic superpower.
Throughout the winter, Germans have been urged to do something that doesn't come naturally, to be idle.
Ich glaube, das war im Winter 2020, als
a series of comic TV ads heaped praise on the nation's couch potatoes. The tongue-in-cheek message, be brave, be a hero, stay at home and do nothing.
Nichts. Absolut gar nichts. Waren faul wie die Waschbären.
Be as lazy as a raccoon and save lives, was the jokey directive in this widely admired ad campaign. Far less popular has been Germany's sluggish vaccination program.
My first shot I will receive only by March 19 and the second by April 9.
80-year-old Hans-Olaf Henkel, former German business leader and former member of the European Parliament, laments the fact that Germany has only jabbed around 7% of its population, compared with around 20% for the US and 28% in the UK.
So we are behind, no question. I might speculate some lives were lost because of that. And that will undoubtedly also have an economic impact.
Henkel says the German government blundered when, for the sake of European solidarity, it handed the procurement of vaccines over to the European Commission. One of Germany's top business gurus, Daniel Stelter, says the Commission clearly bungled the job with the vaccines.
They failed to secure sufficient amounts of vaccines. It is actually, from an economic point of view, a true disaster how they organized the purchasing process for the vaccines.
They dithered and dawdled, he said. Professor Stefan Legger of the University of St. Gallen in Switzerland said the Commission wasted time fighting Big Pharma and haggling over price.
Value for money was emphasized more by the European Union than by the UK government and the American government, and I think that was not the right call.
It wasn't right in terms of saving lives, he says, and not even in economic terms.
I mean, every week of shutdown is more costly than the vaccines.
For Germany, the relative dearth of shots is especially galling, since the first vaccine to be approved by Western regulators came from the US giant Pfizer in partnership with this German company, BioNTech.
At its core, BioNTech is driven by science.
BioNTech may have been driven by science, but the European Commission seems to have been driven by something else as well. Under pressure from France, it placed a large order for a French vaccine, which, it turns out, won't be ready until the fall. All this, says economist Professor Gabriel Felbermayr, has dented German support for the EU.
This failure to play a constructive role in combating the corona disease is not helping the European cause. This failure is one more nail in the coffin.
The German newspaper Die Zeit called the vaccine fiasco the best advertisement for Brexit. But hardly anyone thinks that Germany will follow the British example and leave the bloc. The country's economy is inextricably bound up with the EU. And because of its Nazi past, says Hans-Olaf Henkel, Germany will always play the good European citizen.
The last country to leave the European Union will be Germany, which does not mean that the European Union or the euro will last forever.
He says another eurozone debt crisis is looming thanks to COVID. The EU has agreed a $900 billion recovery fund, a cash injection, if you like, but it remains to be seen how enthusiastic the Germans will be about picking up most of the tab. At the European Desk in London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Not to sound like, ooh, that is not a humble woman right there.
Nothing wrong with celebrating your wins, am I right? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 424 points today, 1.3% for the blue chips, 31,961. The NASDAQ gained 132 points. That's about 0.9% on that particular index. Finished at 13,597. The S&P 500 grew 44 points, 1.1%, 39.25. Johnson & Johnson shot up 1.3% today after the Food and Drug Administration said its single-dose coronavirus candidate has no unexpected safety concerns, as I mentioned. It does, of course, move it a step nearer to distribution. Big meeting this weekend on emergency use authorization, rather. Other vaccine-related stocks, Pfizer down 0.4%, Moderna subtracted 3.5% today. Six Flags Entertainment picked up 4.5% on better-than-expected fourth-quarter revenue. It said people who did get out to the company's theme parks were willing to spend more than anticipated. Disney wrote up 0.2%. SeaWorld gained 2.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, listen to this, 1.38%. Yes, still incredibly low, but you know where it's been. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We got a new report this week from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation about the status of banks in this economy. Generally speaking, they're doing all right. Smaller community banks being the direct object of our attention today. Income up 21% last quarter over a year ago. So Marketplace's Justin Ho made some community banking calls to see what's going on.
The way Chris Duncan at the Illinois-based LaSalle State Bank sees it, the economy this year will be shaped by competing forces. For one,
we'll have more and more folks vaccinated, so hopefully they're out giving the economy a bit of a boost.
But Duncan says an improving economy will likely mean that government relief programs will start winding down.
Once that grant money is gone and those programs have ended and it's time to get back to work and make the money that you need to survive, will the businesses be able to do that?
Duncan isn't so sure. So LaSalle State Bank is setting aside some of the revenue it made last year to cover any defaults that might happen this year. Last quarter, the FDIC says the country's 4,500 community banks hiked their loan loss reserves by nearly 40%.
In my over 40 years in banking, this is the hardest year to budget for with all the moving parts.
Peter Alden is CEO of Bay State Savings Bank in Massachusetts. He says the bank's keeping an eye on several types of loans that have the potential to go bad once government aid goes away.
Whether it's commercial real estate, whether it's, you know, residential lending, consumer lending, you know, if somebody's, you know, has an employment gap, they're going to have an issue paying their bills.
Alden says there's one bright spot in the economy that will continue to shine this year, the housing market. With interest rates near record lows, he says the bank's likely to keep issuing cheap mortgages. David Reiling is CEO of Sunrise Banks in St. Paul, Minnesota. He says lower interest rates will also mean smaller margins for community banks.
That compression of the margin is really going to push banks to look at expenses, find new areas of revenue.
Reiling says many banks may have to limit the number of people they hire, and some might need to close branches. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
Emmy and Academy Award-winning actress Regina King has a new movie out, not one in which she stars, but one of which she is in charge. It's her first time directing a movie called One Night in Miami, about a fictionalized 1964 meeting between Cassius Clay, as Muhammad Ali was known then, Jim Brown, Malcolm X, and Sam Cooke.
I hadn't had an experience as an audience to witness Black men, this four Black men being portrayed in a way that's similar to the men in my life.
So when we talked the other day, I asked Regina King whether it took her directing to get this story told.
Sure. You know, honestly, I feel like not to sound like, ooh, that is not a humble woman right there.
Well, look, let's be honest, right? I mean, come on. We had you on this program a couple of years ago, and you were just starting to move behind the camera. You have now, there's an Emmy, there's an Academy Award, there's your first directorial debut in this film. I mean, come on. It's not like you're nobody.
Well, yeah, but I feel like the roles choose the actor. Mm. And I kind of feel a bit of that as a director, regardless if the story is about a Black woman, about an actress, all of those things that make me who I am, I'm bringing to the storytelling process.
Do me a favor, would you? And this is going to be a little asynchronous here, but situate this movie, right? And what happens in it, these conversations with these four really powerful Black men, arguably at the height of their influence in this country. Situate this movie in this moment in this country today.
Huh. Well, for me going into it, the conversations that these four men were having were always relevant. because unfortunately, the things that they were discussing are happening now, when all of the recent killings of Black people by cops had taken place. Because it was during a pandemic, it made a relevant conversation urgent. We can't say that we love America and not be honest about all of what America is. There, yeah. You know, there are as many qualities that we say, you know, I'm proud to be an American. There are equally as many qualities that are not ones filled with pride, at least for me and for most marginalized people that I know that are American. You know, those things are just as much a part of the fabric of the country as any other.
I want to play a cut from the film here, and it's the character of Malcolm X, played by Kingsley Benadire, talking to Leslie Odom Jr. as Sam Cooke, and then I want to ask you about it. Here you go.
Sam, you have possibly one of the most effective, beautiful outlets of us all. You're not using it to help the cause, bro.
Hell, I'm not. I got the masters to my songs. I started a label. I'm producing tons of Black artists. Don't you think my determining my creative and business destiny is every bit as inspiring to people as you standing up on a podium trying to piss them off?
I don't want to mix my Leslie Odom Jr. roles here, but there's a little bit of Hamilton in here. It's a little bit who gets to tell the story, right? I'm doing it my way, Malcolm X, and you do it yours.
Yeah, and the reality is that both ways are necessary, yeah. When you're talking about using your platform to achieve true equality or equity. They both are necessary. They're situational, right? Depending on what the situation is in that fight, or when they are used together harmoniously. My hope is that what we've presented will people will leave it or have left the film feeling like, yeah, I see where they're both right.
Are you given this moment, right, in this country? And really the moment was last Memorial Day, right? And George Floyd and all that has happened since and the awareness that has been raised. Are you hopeful?
I
Yeah.
Here this is what I'll say. 50 years on this earth and very much aware of our history and how it's repeated itself. My expectations are low, but my energy is high.
You know Regina King from her work, mostly in front of the camera. She goes behind it for her very first feature film director debut. It's called One Night in Miami. Ms. King, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the United States Postal Service and the appearance this afternoon of Postmaster General Louis DeJoy in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee. The official agenda was DeJoy's new strategic plan for the mail, which could include slower delivery and higher costs. There was also, though, well, some heat. DeJoy is not without controversy, and President Biden is taking steps to remove him. Not without a fight, Democratic Congressman Jim Cooper of Tennessee asking the questions here.
How much longer are you planning to stay?
A long time. Get used to me.
All right, we got to go. But here is your midweek moment of economic context or economic curiosity or, I don't know, just what? So you remember that whole GameStop Reddit thing, right? And the short squeezing and the congressional hearings and all of that. GameStop shares today up 104%. 104%, ticker symbol GME. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostedt, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Jay Seabolt, Liana Squilacci, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. They are, once again, the people coming into the studios, so the rest of us don't have to, unless your home internet is terrible. Terrible. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.